Okay, welcome to the Beit Midrash to keep going in our Perek Yoma of Perek Acharon of Yoma, the last chapter of Yoma. I want to do a few housekeeping notes up front because I don't want to forget at the end and then have half the group gone. So we're going to take a 2-week break. We're going to break, and we're not going to meet on Wednesday the 27th, nor will we meet on Wednesday the 3rd. So just to have that on the calendar. And then, hopefully I'm going to make it back on a flight on Wednesday the 24th. But you should put a note in. The flight that was... So I'm going to have to beg your indulgence. We're not going to meet on the 24th. We're not going to meet on the 24th.
But we are meeting on the 10th and the 17th.
Yes, but what I wanted to make clear was the 10th and the 17th. This is January. So we're not going to meet on the 3rd. We will meet on the 10th. We will meet on the 17th. We'll not meet on the 24th. And we will meet on the 31st and thereafter on Wednesdays.
So we don't meet December 27th,
right?
January 3rd, and January 24th.
And correct.
When we do meet on January 10th and 17th.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay? Anybody want to say it a third way?
Let's do it backwards.
Very good. All right, here's what I want to do. Here's the plan as well. The plan is we're going to finish... There are several dapim until you get to the next Mishnah in this chapter. What we're going to do tonight is Nivcharim, those I've chosen to get us through the first Mishnah. Because a lot of the material comes back on itself. We've already discussed a lot of the material about eating that comes in. And though we will do a little bit more about some eating down the line, I want to look at material that's got some... different kind of twists on the big picture that we've been discussing in terms of these five inuyei nefesh, these afflictions, and then set us up for January and the remainder of the weeks until we make a siyum on the end of the chapter, and whenever that will be, then I'll bring either we'll finish the chapter kind of mid next semester and I'll bring some new material, or we'll use this book to look at another couple of things from the different chapters we've got in this volume since we got it for this year. But what I want to do is I want to learn this chapter, but there's no way to finish this chapter tonight, vis-a-vis like thinking about this like semesters. So what I want to do is finish the material for the first Mishnah tonight and then move into the other Mishnayot. The other Mishnayot are interesting. I kind of relearned most of the Perek in cursory ways. We'll go deeper, of course, but I just want to set you up to understand what's coming and why it's worth doing. There is a little bit more about eating and what constitutes food and what constitutes some of the ancient foods are interesting that they're going to mention, and some of the whole notion of whether or not you're really eating and ingesting versus eating, and that will be an interesting thing about the next Mishnah. Some material history of the Talmudic era will come into play too, based on what they're talking about in terms of the foodstuffs around. And I find that to be fascinating. The following after that, it's about really when do you start educating children towards the commandments? And in that sense, people don't often think about that category of children being able to do commandments, but could we ever think about the children being educated towards commandments as also converts being educated towards commandments? Does a convert have to just come in and do everything right at once? Or is there a way to kind of pace yourself as a convert? And is the period before actual conversion, when you're participating, since we don't have things like Eved Ivri or Ger Toshav, categories of people who kind of live with us, right? How do we conceive of the educational process comes out of this Gemara for me? And when do you include them? Well, Yom Kippur would be the obvious answer. Rosh Hashanah would be the obvious answer. And the Barov Ad, Barov Am Hadrat Amelech, so you want to have the gathering of the people. And I want to talk about those philosophical issues that come out of that Gemara, though they're not there explicitly. The following Mishnah will be about pregnant women and sensitivities to pregnant women in the ancient world. The following will be about a building that collapses on Shabbat or Yom Tov. And then the ideas of the ethics of fire, of buried people, but mostly the ethics of triage that come out of it, or the notion of Jews versus non-Jews and our relationships to Jewish versus non-Jewish was classic locus for that discussion. Also about what potentials we saw in the life safety, rescue, emergency services, before it's emergency services. These issues are interesting by way of what the Gemara hopes the community will organize around and know how to do based on the structures that you have. So if you think about it from the perspective of emergency management, this Gemara is a very interesting Gemara. It's an interesting lens. And then finally, the philosophy of tshuva and repentance and what's effective, what's not, is the very end of this chapter. So there's a whole lot to do, and that's the reason why I don't want to just say, you know, ad kan to here this semester. We did Yoma, we'll do something else next time, because there's just such rich material to come. Okay? So let's now go into our inyan for the night, our issue for the night, the first matter of the evening, on page 77A4. Ayin Zayin Aleph, towards the bottom, the very bottom. Last two lines, really, of the Gemara. Even the last line, I think. Okay, here we go. So the right-hand column, where the Gemara goes into the fifth prohibition cited in the Mishnah. Tashmish Hamita, cohabitation, sexual relations. Tashmish Hamita de'ikrei nui minava. From where do we know that abstaining from cohabitation, from abstaining from sex, is called an affliction? Right? The Ruth Westheimer joke on that matter is, if that's an affliction on Yom Kippur, I'm walking around so often. Afflicted! 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 There you go. You know, Dr. Ruth spoke at an event for first day school that I was the head of. People said, really? We're going to have Dr. Ruth? I mean, should we be talking about that? I said, do you know the rabbis even in the Talmud talk about that? So, Dichtiv, it's written, I'm going to prove to you that abstaining from cohabitation is indeed an affliction. Im tane et binotai ve'im tikach nashim. So I have a verse in Genesis chapter 31. And Laban is taking leave of Jacob. In other words, Jacob is going with his daughters, Rachel and Leah. And he says, if you afflict my daughters, it says, or here, I would say, and you'll take wives in addition to them. So what he means to say is that I want you to take an oath. One, if you understand these things as being disconnected, one, don't afflict my daughters. Im ta'ane et binotai. You're going to take them wherever you're taking them. Don't afflict them. And two, don't take wives in addition to my daughters. But maybe they're connected. Maybe the ideas in the psuk are indeed connected. By taking other wives, you will afflict my daughters. How will that be the case? Turn the page. Im tane mitashmish. Here, Laban has Jacob forswear two types of affliction. If you will afflict my daughter's concerns abstaining from cohabitation. Ve'im tikach mitzarot, and if you'll take, in other words, if you take the wives, that concerns rival wives. So the first im tane, according to the Gemara's interpretation of the verse, is actually the tane of withholding conjugal rights, cohabitation. And im tikach creates a situation where you have rival wives. And you know that the despair of the first wife is investigated over time and just recently was highlighted in a very intense article. There's this saying that they attribute to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He said, "If to live with the Parsha is to live with the times." Yeah? Living with the Parsha is living with the times. I kind of find that it's true no matter what my Seder of Limud is, no matter what I'm learning. If you're learning something, the world is going to reflect exactly what you're learning. And one's going to inform the other very deeply, right? So here I am, I'm preparing this week, I'm thinking a lot about what this verse is talking about and a lot of what rival wives, you know, and the note here says, Lavan had Jacob swear with regard to two conjugal matters. One, he expressly stipulated that you shouldn't withhold the conjugal rights, the cohabitation, and others, they're going to be afflicted by rival wives. So I get the new issue of Jerusalem Report. I don't know if anybody gets the magazine. It's a bi-weekly magazine.
I thought they stopped printing it. When did it stop again? That's where Sharon worked.
Jerusalem Report?
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Sharon who? Sharon Ashley Wright was an editor of the Jerusalem Report.
Yeah.
But they went under new editorial board and new publishers.
Okay. We don't need to take up that.
But it's around. It's around. People who are interested, it's a magazine about, it's an English publication out of Israel, gamut of issues and areas of coverage, culture to politics, to Torah, to books, to drama. It's a lovely, lovely magazine. People want to say that they're this angle and they want to say that they're that angle. The journalism has gone down since the days that Jay's making reference to someone we know who worked and wrote there. I think the journalism has gone down. But now and then there's a great story. Just like New York Times Magazine these days, I feel. I don't know if people feel the same way. But anyway, The front cover of this week's Jerusalem Report is Bedouins taking second wives. And the impact on the first wife and the struggle the first wife has once there's a rival wife. Now, signs of virility, more children, siring more children is the way that this kind of virility is proven, the power, the strength of the man. They go through that. You know, it could be that they're still holding to what was a very ancient way of life. Very ancient way of life. And most likely it is thousands of years old. And in the midst of what we're talking about with Jacob and our ancestors, very close to some of how we lived. And the article is intense because not just for the infidelity that some jump to when they think about the rival wife getting sexual attention, but for the fact that there's an entirety of playing out of do I desire her more than I desire you? Am I the favored one? Am I not the favored one? All this, I'm sure not lost on any of us here. But that comes out of the Gemara. And they're linking this kind of withholding of not only conjugal rights, but withholding, and I think what's happening here is that we're expanding on what the affliction really is. There is a withholding of the notion that my relationship is with you. You are primary in my life. A la what a husband and a wife ought to be feeling towards one another and the kind of power of relationship that we wind up defining as the most salient and the most loving and the most supportive and the most expressive of our potential connection with God. But instead, on Yom Kippur, the potential connection with a wife is secondary, and it's got to be foremost with God. And here, because they're talking about withholding that conjugal right and the rival, it's like I'm withholding not only the conjugal right, but I'm we're afflicting ourselves, and we know this day. I think this is the overlay of how the mitzvah is really being explicated, that I'm withholding also the love and the affection and the desire that you'd feel, just like it would happen if he took other wives and had rival wives. So that's on the mitzvah level of how I have to experience the day. Here, there's a direct link to the notion of cohabitation being an affliction by drushing the pasuk to say that the ta'aneh here, the use of the verbal root of affliction, is to withhold cohabitation, conjugal rights. And again, you don't want to also have this taking rival wives. And ve'ema idi ve'idi mitzarot, but say that both clauses actually concern taking rival wives. And so the verse provides no support for the notion that you're actually talking about the cohabitation itself, the physical sex act. You're not really having any support if both ends of it, im ta'ane and im tikach, if you afflict and if you take, are about the rival wives. Because that's kind of like reading it like, if you'll afflict them by taking rival wives. If I read the verse just as teaching me that one thing, I can't say that it's about teaching me at all about the sex act itself. Gemara answers, mi ketiv im tikach, if it's written if you'll take additional wives, no? V'im tikach ketiv, or if you'll take, is written. And since this second clause is prefaced by the word or, it cannot be the explanation of the first clause, meaning that they're reading the vav of the verse not as and or by, but as or. And now and then, indeed, in biblical grammar at least, you can have the vav be in an or kind of position. So the Gemara knows that dikduk mikra'i. It knows that biblical grammar. And comes out of Midrash, and it comes out of the whole notion of the system of biblical grammar. The Gemara, though, is going to persist in the challenge. Ve'ema idi ve'idi mitzarot. But nonetheless, let me say that both clauses concern taking rival wives. Chad l'tzarot didei. One clause referring to his already espoused rival wives. V'chad l'tzarot da'atyan le'ma'alma. And one clause referring to rival wives that would come to him from the outside world. Meaning what? That in the second clause, Laban and Jacob swear that he would not take new wives in the future. Now, say that in the first clause then, what's that going to represent? Laban and Jacob had swear that he would not elevate his concubines, Bilhah and Zilpah, to the status enjoyed by Rachel and Leah. Now that's a whole big kind of issue. Rashi actually gives us when we're trying to really understand this, you see that the it's quoting the Rashi. Shelo yase Bilha v'zilpa gvirot shavot lahen v'hadar ashba'e im tikach nashim dahainu tzarot atyan lehu levatar hachi me'alma. So it's basically what the translation said, but I want to read it inside that he says that the issue is Bilha and Zilpah. And when the Torah deals with Bilha and Zilpah, remember, these are the handmaidens of Rachel and Leah, right? When the Torah defines them, if you look at the language in Chumash, in the Torah, it gets back to a place where, in the end, they are simply the shifchot. They are the handmaidens. They are not wives. Whereas in the ancient world, you could have given them status as wives if they were going to bear children. And so that's the workout of Torah's language, and it's the workout of the rabbis to understand their position. And here the drosh is, don't ta'aneh them, don't ta'aneh my daughters, meaning let Bilhah and Zilpah become equal status wives, and don't let them take other wives, meaning Ba'alma, those who are going to be from the surrounding area, who want to either make peace treaties or just Jacob goes and says, oh, I've got to take other wives from the people around here or from anywhere. So what if it means that? The Gemara is going to reject that approach, though. Ki kativ, mi kativ im tikach v'im ta'ane. Is it written, if you'll take additional wives or if you'll afflict, which is more logical order according to the interpretation you're suggesting? You can't really make your suggestion of the limud of your suggestion of the interpretation because of the order of the clauses. I would have suspected the clauses to be reversed if it was about Bilhah Zilpah and others in the world. Im tane ve'im tikach kativ, but it's instead with the verbs in this order, afflict and if you'll take, which implies that affliction is the greater evil. Thus the affliction must refer to abstaining from cohabitation and not the taking of rivals. So we're in this place where the Gemara feels, I can indeed interpret the clause im tane, if you'll afflict my daughters, as withholding from them conjugal rights, withholding from them cohabitation. Amar le Rav Papa le Abaye, and there's a follow-up. Ha tashmish gufa ikri inui. But how can abstaining from cohabiting be an affliction when cohabitation itself is called an affliction? Wait, you know, we're going to talk about the themes that they're playing out and with here, right? Is cohabitation an affliction? Dichtiv vayishkav otava yaneha. As it's written, he lay with her and afflicted her. Meaning, in the Shechem story, that there is an affliction when he rapes her. And since the sex act is rape in that situation, it is an affliction entirely, and therefore itself, the sex act becomes, potentially, we will say, because it's the Gemara and we're discussing it, an affliction.
I think the better word instead of affliction is torment. And grammatically it fits better in my, the way I hear the sentence, because it is a subject verb object, and you torment someone. So the grammar is better for me, but even the meaning. An affliction can be you get a skin rash or an illness or something that's an affliction, but torment is also emotional here, which is, fits what you just said about the rape situation. So you can lie with a woman and torment her at the same time because maybe she's doing something she doesn't want to, or against her will or something like
right.
that. So it's possible to have le'anot, the verb le'anot is literally torment or even torture in extreme cases, but torment is better here because it does imply that emotional part, and it fits better with this last phrase. I was waiting for you to get to that sentence because of that. I saw it coming.
Right, and you want to add to your definition. Let me add to your definition the last piece here.
It's not avoiding sex; it's doing it in the wrong way.
And withholding, because the last Abaye says, Hatam she'ina mi biot acherot, and also then he says, I did it the once, I tormented you, I tortured you, I did this against your will, and now I'm not even going to come, nor marry you, nor grant you any cohabitation. So there's torture and torment within it. And nice, because I think that what you're doing is you're using, again, the material of the Gemara to figure out the translation that's best suited. And in this case, that verb, in this context particularly, is more about torment and torture than it is simply afflict.
I don't know which masechet in the Talmud there is a basic menu based on the profession of the husband, how many times
it's in ketubot.
He's supposed to have sex with his wife.
Right.
So, and it's not every day.
So unless you're a Talmid Chacham.
Wait a minute. He can have a few wives without la'anot any other of them.
Yeah.
So I don't know why they bring it as ilui. And in the Muslim world, you're allowed to have 11 wives legally.
So Ron's making reference to a very unique Mishnah that comes in the Sechet Ketubot about conjugal rights. And it's really a woman's right, not that it's an obligation.
No, it's obligation of the husband to come in.
It's a woman's right. So it's connected to, in the ketubah, her right for what's called conjugal rights, in other words, for cohabitation. And they definitely allow for people who are traveling salesmen and merchants and folks who can't be there every day and folks who work hard in this way to not have an everyday obligation, should she want it. Remember, it's all by permission.
Yeah, but it's all with, on that top.
It's with her rights first in that Mishnah case. So we have to state it the way it is. And it so happens that certain people who are close because they're just studying down the street should go home every day, and you know there should be a desire on an everyday level when it's, of course, permissible. Because in the great rhythms of family purity laws, remember, that the rabbis allow for sex at some time during the month.
For multiple wives.
Right. So it is better for multiple. So one of the issues that's at play here is going to be this whole world of cohabitation, conjugal rights, single wives versus multiple wives. Right? Did you want to say something before I go on? Oh, I thought you did. So what I want to do for a minute or two is explore this as it comes within the context of, again, Yom Kippur. Imagining that we're exploring it in the context of, just for the moment, a husband and a wife in a monogamous relationship. Imagine for a moment. And imagine it's a monogamous relationship in the greater context of the possibility that exists that there is polygamy. There is more than one wife possible at this point in Jewish history. So when we express the connection we have to God in Yom Kippur, during Yom Kippur, and we withhold the kind of priority place, desire, relational connection, support, love, whatever it manifested as, you know, because you have to not let the love relationship, romantic relationship of our age inform what marriage was all the time in the ancient world. There's a lot of expediency in marriage, financially and safety-wise. Though, you know, we've all watched Fiddler and, you know, they learn how to love after how many years, right? We don't know exactly what those narratives sounded like, looked like. But it's in this world of possibility that more than one wife can really be in your life, if you're the man in this picture. And the Gemara here is throwing a little bit of a commentary in on what could happen in your household if, in fact, you marry more than one. If, in fact, you had more than one relationship going, might be part of the curriculum again in terms of what's being discussed for reflection on Yom Kippur. When I withhold that kind of physical intimacy, affection, right? And by the way, if it was the quote-unquote wrong time of the month and it wasn't possible anyway, what am I really doing if I have to do this mitzvah? If it's not a little bit more deeply connected to my distancing myself? Right? Because if it was only about physicality and I couldn't do it anyway, then I wouldn't have a mitzvah to do. So I think it brings up the issue of rival wives, because there is some question about what you're going to do vis-a-vis staying in a monogamous situation or taking on other wives. Right here, in again, on the pages of Yom Kippur. And what better day than to figure out my relationships in the world and the power of my relationship in the world and the power of my relationship with God and the power of my relationship with my wife. And what I want to suggest is that the possibility for a polygamous situation is a little bit more possible than we like to think in the world of the Talmud. But it wasn't the absolute norm, as we've stated before. And we stated this last year. We talked a lot about this when we learned Gittin. And we talked all about this. But I found more about this overall inyan, this matter, that I'd like to share with you a little bit. First, a little bit from the Jewish Law Association studies, had a 2002 conference at the State University of New York at Binghamton. I'll read part of this paper on the subject. And then there's this really fascinating paper that I found on infertility as ground for polygamy in Jewish law in Italy, interactions among legal traditions at the time of the Renaissance. Leave that one for a second. Okay, so let me go over here and say that he starts out patterns of marriage. Today, the common pattern of marriage in the world is the monogamous one, but the exclusive union of one man and one woman is not the only one possible in the eyes of the law and of society. Anthropologists maintain that if societies in all times and all places known to science are taken into account, the monogamous pattern of marriage is the less frequent one. Nevertheless, Western society, which has dominated the world in the past 500 years, has adopted the monogamous model, which is why the model is important in the legal debate in Israel. So you know the context. And Ashkenazi Jews. The Western model of monogamous marriage gained common currency in the Ashkenazi tradition. At the beginning of the second millennium, Jews residing in Northern and Western Europe began to develop a monogamous pattern of marriage under the leader of Rabbi Gershom Meor HaGolah. Two regulations named after him were enacted, which banned bigamy and divorcing a woman against her will. These restrictions had several legal repercussions. Their legal foundation was legislation of a public criminal nature that held sway over the breadth of Ashkenazi and French Jewish culture, including extensive ramifications in Eastern Europe. The causes that justify the relaxation of these regulations, which were accepted as a result of the restrictions imposed upon men, greatly reduced and qualified the possibility of relaxing the regulations, even in cases in which the man had a good reason to request it. Prominent trends among Ashkenazi halacha scholars justified setting aside the regulations, especially when the ground was based on subjective factors having to do with the woman's behavior. But even if the man's claim was found to be justified, the procedure necessary to set aside the regulations, the approval of 100 rabbis from 3 countries, was so strict and encumbering that it greatly diminished even this possibility of breaching the established framework. The system strictly protected the regulations and issued stringently enforced bans against whoever violated them without proper authorization. The regulations were accepted entirely both in the legal and the social sense by Jews living in these regions, so that the Jewish and Christian families became identical as far as polygamy was concerned. Now, we have a section here, the Babylonian Talmud and the Eastern Tradition. According to the Talmudic law formulated by Rava, and this is going to be in Yevamot, a man can marry other women in addition to the first wife without limit, as long as he can meet all his responsibilities towards all his wives. The woman has no recourse to a direct means of preventing another wife from joining her household, although she has some indirect means, as, for example, specifying a high sum in the ketubah, which he would have to pay if the marriage were dissolved, or setting high alimony payments and other legally mandated expenses which might deter other women from marrying the man. This pattern is close to the Muslim model, but more moderate, because the provision whereby a man can marry more than one wife, only if he can satisfy all their needs, incorporates in the very law that allows polygamy a restriction that has the potential to limit the phenomenon. And so we see that Yevamot legislation was a limiting legislation, financially. Over here, I want to argue, footnote to the paper, that there's a spiritual sense of limiting the possibility for the polygamous, for the bigamy, because in Masechet Noma, when it comes to talking about Yom Kippur and the possibility that you'll bring rivalry and affliction or even torment into the home, as a matter of course, if you take on rival wives, im tikach, right? Because the verse says, if you will, like with a situation, like, if you'll do this, that spiritually, there's a warning in our Masechta to not engage in doing this, because it's going to create all kinds of potential affliction. So, I think it's an additional piece to what the paper presented, and it's about the scope of what's in there. They go into, anyone interested, I can send you the PDF, they go into how some of this background impacts modern day thinking in Israel about multiple wives, right? Because remember, some communities did not accept Rabbeinu Gershom, and then modern Israel was a place where you couldn't do it. Today, the law on the books, even for the Bedouin, whom I mentioned in the Jerusalem report, is that they can't have second wives either, but up to about now, though it was being discussed early 2000s, up to about now, they weren't ever really enforcing this, except now, they're starting to enforce this vis-a-vis the Bedouin community, because they see that it's created rival wives, and some are let go, some are beaten by their own families, tortured by their own families, who bring embarrassment on if they can't stand the fact that they've been displaced by another wife or another, or yet another. There are shelters in municipalities for women from the Bedouin community who want to make the jump and leave because they're nervous about their families and because they're nervous about their husbands and what the reaction is going to be. And there are adoptive families who provide funding for people to finish their high school diplomas and college degrees and training and vocational training and to get themselves on their feet from the Bedouin community today. So this is a new phenomenon since about 2000. Well, it's not that it's entirely new, but the enforcement, according to this latest reportage that I looked at in the Jerusalem report, says that it's now being really enforced in a different way. You know, how far does that go? How much enforcement? How big is the group to enforce it? Are there a few standout cases, and now we're getting a little publicity? I'm not really sure, but fascinating.
What about the Haredi community? Do we have this happening still in
it? The quick answer about the Haredi community, the quick answer is in some quick looks through material that I've done, and I didn't bring any of the articles, is that A, the phenomenon of taking a pilegesh, of having a mistress.
Not a mistress, another one. I know.
So first of all, I found more about taking a pilegesh than I found about taking a wife. And since we're not talking about mistresses right now, I wasn't going to now, but since you asked, I found more about that in some of the papers, in Israeli papers, than I did about second wives.
There's a guy in England, I think he's Jewish, he divorced seven women, and they all live together on his farm, so he lives with his seven divorcees. This way, he doesn't do anything against the British law. And they all live in a commune, and they have children, like maybe 20, I don't know how many. And they live out of his farm. And that's the way he did it. Amazing, right? So you need to divorce to get the other one.
Is that on? No, that's not in here. Not in here. What's fascinating is that there's all kinds of very rational approaches to human sexuality, married life, multiple wives, married life. You know, there's some arguments in communities in America itself about the nature of relationships, marriages, potentials that, you know, there could be multiple women, mothers within a family structure that makes sense. As I read you in that paper, they're cognizant of the fact that the monogamous outlook for the last X number, 100, you know, Rabbeinu Gershom was already a millennium ago. That's not the majority. That's not the majority. I'm not an expert in the world now in how many countries really have monogamous versus polygamous marriages, but I it's fascinating. I just want to share with you a little bit more about the meeting of all kinds of cultures in Italy. You know, that when you talk about any paper about Renaissance Italy, you have to remember that Italy in the Renaissance was a real meeting of various Jewish cultures in a new kind of atmosphere or a new kind of environment. Even though you have Romano Jews and Jews there from a long time ago in the Roman Empire, predating the destruction of the temple by several hundred years, you have an influx from that being the earliest part of the early modern period, if you will, of moving towards Eastern Europe and Italy. And so French Rhineland Jews, Spanish, Moroccan Spanish Jews, Italians, and some from the Middle East, Egyptian Jews.
I believe that the Ashkenazim came out of Italy up into the Rhineland. That's where they originated. It was a migration.
Right. So you could say that they're back to some of their roots, right? But it was so different during the Renaissance period, based on a buildup of halachic parlance and halachic code literature, and so much that's happened within the Ashkenazic scene of the Rhineland of Franco-German area, that it's hard to say that they're just kind of like now returning to a Jewish way of life from the ancient times. But yes, you had some of those. The ban on multiple wives, according to the paper, did not spread to medieval Spain and Provence. We know of polygamy in Spain, especially in cases where the husband wished to fulfill the fertility commandment or the levirate marriage, meaning he had a brother who died and they didn't have a child, and so the other brother takes the spot and marries the bride, and then he has a child in his brother's name, right? Nevertheless, polygamy was not widespread in those countries because of the custom of promising in the ketubah not to take another wife, and because of the law of the land forbid it. Okay, so that's interesting. The ketubah is used in even stronger terms here versus this expression of the ketubah just being outlining more expenses. Here it said, no, you won't do it, especially because the law of the land was the law. Dina de malchuta dina is the expression we say in Hebrew, that you have a principle that you've got to follow the law. Because in Christendom, of course, it was like that. This was not the case among Ashkenazi Jews who moved to Spain and Provence. The rabbis there acknowledged the validity of the ban, but only concerning Ashkenazi Jews, but granted it lesser legal status than it enjoyed in Ashkenaz. Rashba, author of most of the Spanish responsa concerning the ban, ruled that any cause based on Talmudic law took precedence over the ban, such as cases where the man wished to fulfill the fertility commandment, pru or vu. So if she didn't have children, you could actually say that the ban is undone. And where the wife was insane, and surely in cases where the wife behaved immorally. In general, in Spain, the ban was viewed as a ruling designed to protect the wife from arbitrary conduct on the part of her husband, to place restrictions on men who chase women and abuse their wives, as Rashba put it in a tshuva. Therefore, when the husband had just cause, the rabbis in Spain ruled that the ban did not apply. In Ashkenaz, in contrast, just cause was not sufficient for waiving the ban. So just cause is not sufficient. Inappropriate conduct on the part of the wife was also required. Apparently in Ashkenaz, the ban was not only intended to protect the woman, but also to establish a new family pattern, essentially founded on monogamy, and not allowing a man to divorce his wife without her consent. Now the first reference to the ban in Italy dates from the 15th century, to get you to Italy now. And here we have responsa, and we have the community in here, Italian Jewish ethnic groups date back to ancient times. He's going to say this in his own way now. Ashkenazi and French Jews who began arriving in the second half of the 14th century. Many Spanish and Portuguese Jews who came after the expulsion in 1492. Romaniotes who lived in regions conquered by the Italian states in the Balkans and the Greek islands. Each of these had its own socio-legal heritage. And so the decisions in Italy become very interesting by way of what's going to be, if you will, into the future. And in Italy, notwithstanding the non-Ashkenazi ethnic groups living there, the ban is accepted. This is understandable in northern Italy, since most of the Jews there were from Ashkenaz, and the ban was already an integral part of their legal heritage. Rabbi Judah Mintz, the leading Italian rabbi in the second half of the 15th century, ruled that the ban applied everywhere unless proven otherwise. A different limitation on the validity of the ban first appeared in Jewish legal sources from 15th century Italy, the claim that the validity of the ban had expired at the end of the 5th millennium. So now Jews start to say, wait a minute, didn't this ban end? That was first claimed in a response of Rabbi Joseph ben Solomon Cologne, the Maharik, citing Rabbi Shlomo ben Abraham Adret, the Rashba, and later spread throughout Jewish legal works. So there's some argumentation on a halachic basis that maybe it ended. Their arguments provide an exhaustive discussion of the question, but no definitive answer really comes out. In some, the bans followed in Italy under the period of discussion. So what's fascinating is that there's discussion about this. There's discussion about this. And in the nature of our human experience and our experience on the holiest day of the year and what we're to reflect upon, if this is the curriculum, we are to imagine ourselves in these relationships and try to make sense of perhaps the inclination to take other wives if you're a man. That ta'aneh and that mitzvah of no cohabitation now has a much different valence after learning the Gemara than simply don't get close. Don't get close that day. Right? That to me is a dynamic part of the Talmudic literature. Absolutely dynamic. And having not only Talmud, but history of halacha, history of the matter, and understandings today of proclivities and the nature of relationships and what people are, I would say, I guess today, what they're experimenting with by way of infidelity. It makes a lot of sense that it would be written into the very core of our most spiritual day of the year. If I didn't want to do more text, we could keep going. I mean, who's watched the TED Talk from this child of Holocaust survivors who's become now the voice about infidelity in our time and redefining infidelity? It's a fascinating 20-minute TED Talk to listen to. Her name, if you want, and I'm not remembering it.
It's under the paper, you'll see.
And there's also an article by her, like what I told you, living with the Gemara is living with the times, in Tablet Magazine. It's one of the top articles. Her new take on what infidelity represents. And though she says, no, I'm not for it, she says so many people will experience it that she's starting to think about it as a therapist, as this is kind of like an opportunity for resilience within your relationship if this happens to you.
That's just today or yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's just today. I think it's just today. But I had watched her TED Talk a little while ago. If you go to the TED app, those of you who have it, and you put in infidelity, you will find her 20-minute talk. Yeah, that's what I wish. I just use the key word. You know that if you go to the, hold on, I'll get you the name.
There's a name for it nowadays called polyamory.
Well, that's right. I mean, there are
people who do it.
So here, Esther Perel, P-E-R-E-L, 21 minutes, 31 seconds of a talk that's very deeply reflective on the human situation in terms of monogamous relationships infidelity the reality. Now, I think she's creating far too what sounds like permissive a culture. Period. But she is trying to understand, as old as the institution of marriage is, she says, is the institution of infidelity. In our thinking about sources, in our thinking about our own halachic legal history where certain Jews did have multiple wives, is part of a multiple wife reality speaking to the very kind of evolutionary reality of men that we are understanding, or is that evolutionary framing of everything simply justification for behavior that doesn't reach the highest moral ground, the highest human experience, the growing together, growing old together, going through experience together, all that the kedusha, the holiness of marriage is really all about, partnership is really all about. You know, a person, a community have to decide for him or herself or for themselves what it's really all about. I think, again, she's going on a direction that's, you know, way too permissive, way too even sanctifying the institution, if you will, without her even realizing it. But it's worth hearing some of her reflections on it, because we have our own reflections on it. You have to know what you're up against. And if there is any wisdom in there, a pearl here or there, for enhancing our own partnerships in whatever way we have those, then, you know, I think that there's something there.
You said earlier about mistresses in a Haredi community, did I get you wrong?
Yeah.
But in that case, do they come up with some situation that would permit it?
I don't want to go into a whole halacha of the...
There are cases that...
Not starting, it's been. It's been.
And it's condoned?
They are keeping it very quiet.
That's why I'm asking.
So, you know,
the rabbis give okay, but it's very, very quiet, and it's very, very common.
I mean, this is a whole different issue, but yes, there is some sense of...
That would be based because of fertility, because of... What would permit that?
It's
anything from spilling the seed in wrongful ways to desire being fulfilled with a woman who's permitted to you because she's not an Eshet Ish. She's not married. You're not having an adulterous affair if you're a man doing that with a woman in this status, and that being more optimal than other kinds of pleasure practices.
By the way, in 48...
How widespread it is, again, I'm not claiming to know. And all I know is I was once questioned about a specific case, living in Jerusalem in the marketplace, and whether or not I knew about the status of this woman, et cetera, et cetera. And then, unfortunately, it's probably more widespread than we know, and, of course, you want to look at modern society, it's more widespread. There are apps for these things.
Yeah,
people,
I'm being specific about the Haredi.
So it's everyone.
Yeah.
I'm being specific about Haredi in the way that I know them, but I'm also being specific about everyone in our community who, you know, you never really know.
By the way, in 1948, the Israeli government, after the war, we had 10,000 men died in that war. So there were a lot of women with no potential husbands. So there was real discussion or to allow multiple wives, or another option was to bring men from Czechia, because we had very good relations with the Czechs at the time, to bring them to Israel. But nothing was done, and it was left as it is. It was really discussed in the Knesset and in the government.
That's interesting. Do you have a book or an article about that?
I'm sure there is. I mean, but it was a very... My mother had many, many, many girlfriends her age that never got married.
Interesting.
It was a real issue.
Yeah. Okay, let's push on. Let's do some more text. I want to do the pieces of text now for some of the next afflictions and some of the next philosophical twists or invitations to think through some of these pieces about our first Mishnah. Washing oneself. We're going to do a couple of sources here. Because washing oneself is also part of the Inui Nefesh, the affliction. You're going to see a Braita now. Tanu Rabbanan. The rabbis taught in this Braita. Asur lirchotz miktsat gufo b'chol k'chol gufo. It's forbidden to wash a part of your body, just as it's forbidden to wash one's entire body. V'im hayam miluchlach betit uvetzoa. But if he had soiled himself with mud or excrement, rochetz kedarko. You can wash yourself as you usually do. Right? So, actually, not to get too graphic about things, or disgusting, but someone once was wearing a pair of sandals and stepped in the wrong pile of muck. Right? Yes, you can wash your feet. Yes. Ve'eno rochet kedarko. Ve'eno choshesh. And you need not be concerned. Sorry. So you rochet kedarko, ve'eno choshesh. And don't be concerned. And you see the note 11, Meiri says, the prohibition against washing on Yom Kippur applies only about washing for pleasure. Asur lasuch miketzat gufo kechol gufo. Similarly, it's forbidden to anoint part of one's body, just as it's forbidden to anoint one's entire body. V'im haya chole, but if it was sick, o shehayu lo hatatin b'roshu, or he had scabs on his head, sach kedarko. You have to anoint yourself as you usually do. V'eino choshesh, and you shouldn't be concerned that it violates any of the prohibitions. Very, very human, very real, and you know, you could imagine the kind of splitting hairs that might go on if someone really was trying to do this and they thought d'oraita by Torah law, they couldn't do this or else they'd be excommunicated and suffer the mitat beitin, suffer the consequences of the beitin of heaven, that they would be excommunicated and even, you know, done for, right? But on the other hand, you read this and you could say oppositely, like, if you really have a need to wash yourself, or you have a need to put a little ointment on something, the Braita, at least, if you're going to opine by the Braita, is, don't worry. Ein choshesh. Right? And we need a little bit more, like, don't worry in halacha, at the same time that we need a little bit more attention to detail. Where do you really pay attention to detail, and where do you really say, you know what, don't worry about that?
Tension and between what it says literally and what the intention is. That's in any, in
yeah, you could relate it to that. You could relate it to that. Kava, keva, and kavana. Kavana is intention. Keva is the set.
The whole judicial system, modern judicial system.
Yeah.
Whether you're a strict constructionist or you believe in interpreting more situations.
I mean, right, even to that level, right,
sure.
Of philosophy, of legal philosophy, you could say that if I'm sitting here and I'm stuck on worrying that I'm going to be cut off forever from my people because I have to put a little ointment on the scab, that it could be like the expression of strict constructionist in a certain way, but I'm not going to press it all the way there, you know, because if I did that, I would have to say that, you know, Torah law sometimes that says, don't light a fire on Shabbos. I might have to say, oh, but what do I need it for beyond the one situation, saving someone's life, which I can do. I can stoke the fire and I can cook soup for someone who's ill. But I'm not to be too interpretive. So, somewhere in the middle.
Isn't an aberration because most laws, you always go stricter.
Well,
it's safer
to go stricter, and that's kind of been the attitude and outlook of many who, like, go lechumra. They say lechumra, right? But then there are a lot of reactions to, especially in modernity, of those who go lechumra and don't use law to understand what is permissible. and to match the possible with the law. Right? So where do I start? Like, is law a matter of making possible and doing it the most holy way? Or is law a matter of putting a fence around things and stopping you from doing it? You know, so I think that there's a big debate. There's a big debate. I once heard, my favorite sermon on that topic was by Rabbi Yosef Kanevsky, who I think I mentioned at least, maybe I mentioned him here, maybe not. It was the Sidur class, maybe. He's a rabbi on the West Coast. He was an assistant of Rabbi Avi Weiss's, fantastic thinker, modern Orthodox guy. Women were carrying Torah long before it was even on the map, and women clergy, things like this in modern Orthodoxy. You know, Rabbi Kanevsky, he presented once the tshuva of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein on milk in America. Now, milk in America, since it's basically pasteurized and taken care of, and there's not any fear of anything, he goes through, he tells you the whole process, he talks about milk production, he gives you every reason why you should buy any milk, he tells you that you could, you know, trust the national brand, you could even trust in America this brand, and then you know, 23 pages of beautiful analyses and scientific reasons why you shouldn't have any wonder and worry, and then he says at the very end, but those who are more machmir, but those who are really strict on themselves and will only drink Chalav Yisrael and will only drink the milk supervised totally by Jews, you know, that the Jews are there, you know, the udders, and the Jews are the ones carrying the cans and the Jews are the ones flicking the switch. The Hareze Meshubach. They're praiseworthy. You know, so culturally, it's kind of now in the veins of the Jewish people to be more machmir, to be more machmir. And we see that, right? We see that with certain communities. Law sometimes sets us free, actually, versus restricts us. And so if you read it too much, though, you worry like Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch did in the Germany of the 19th century, that it's a slippery slope and, you know, what you're done with, you're off the mountain. By that, you know, Sinai's way in the distance and you don't have a rear view. That's what his worry was. All right, let's keep going. The Gemara discusses another case of permissible washing. I'm on the right-hand column, last line there on 77b1. Tana Devei Menashe. So one of the sages from the Academy of Menashe taught the following. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer. Shimon ben Gamliel says, Midi chaisha yada achad b'mayim v'notenet pat latino. A woman may wash one hand with water and then give bread to her child. So, right, hygiene is important within the tradition. We've always said it. Here's a braita that talks about washing before you touch the bread and giving it to your child. Ve'eina chosheshet. And don't be worried. Don't be worried you violated anything. Amru laval shamai hazaken. And here we brought this topic up a different time, the one that's about to be reinforced. I told it to you as it was a matter of, here it's a braita, so it's the same kind of text as the Tosefta that we read. Remember, we read the parallel text to the Mishnah, the Tosefta, that said the following as well. Shelo ratza l'ha'achil b'yado achat. He didn't want to feed his child with even one hand, right? Because he's so worried that he should touch food, right? He says, don't eat. Don't touch. You know, how far is he going to go? V'gazru alav l'ha'achil b'shtei yadayim. But his colleagues decreed upon him that he was to feed him with both hands. Meaning what? A, he's going to wash both hands, and he's not going to be choshesh. He's not going to worry at all. They're not worried at all that he actually washes his hands for the hygienic purpose of actually feeding his child. And two, this was the point that we made when we read the Tosefta together, that yes, you're going to feed your child. Yes, you are. Gazru alav. That is such strong language. So you're going to take care of the children. V'gazru alav l'hachil v'shtei yadayim. My Tama, what's the reason washing the hands is permitted in this case? Amar baye mishum shivta, because of shivta. Now if you look down below, it says that shivta, Rashi identifies shivta with the evil spirit resting on one's hands when you awake in the morning. So why did you wash with the cup in the morning? Why does Chabad still legislate that and several groups still get up, first thing they do is negel vasser, they wash their hands? So the evil spirits rest on the hands.
I thought this was only in the diaspora, not in Israel.
Yeah, even in Israel. But
Shivta stayed in Poli.
But the reality is that evil spirit they could have used such a superstitious, why do we sometimes use superstitious stuff in order to kind of create the worry or create the intentionality behind something? Because if we say, like, there's evil spirits on your hand, maybe it's going to stick more than your hands are dirty and you're going to transfer some kind of sickness when you give your kid bread. So who knows? Maybe superstition was a way to say, take care of yourself. Okay, so the next is going to be a little bit of a section that comes to say how important it is that on, and we're talking, again, here we are, Yom Kippur, how important it is to go visit someone who's great in your life, either your father or your teacher. And because we're in the Yom Kippur tractate, what's very interesting about that to me is that if I build in time to go on a trip to visit my teacher or my father across a river, even some kind of body of water on Yom Kippur, that means that all those Ashkenazim who put in all those piyutim and kept us in shul all day, they weren't really reading this. You know, like, think about what they're saying here. Now, there's an alternative that there's the notion that you could be talking about the person who really does need to go visit his elderly father or elderly teacher. And yes, you're going to even be excused from tefillot, even though tefillot are big and long and serious and important that day. So I'm thinking that it could be also a matter of you got to prioritize making sure that you visit the right people on Yom Kippur if you can. And there's the discussion that's going to come about the lecture, meaning we've talked about this in the Shabbat context, that on Shabbat afternoon they would come to the Beit Midrash and they would learn the rabbinic ways and cultures and drush, and they would hear Torah explicated, and that's going to happen also on Yom Kippur too. So the whole notion of study on Yom Kippur and the give and take of the rabbi and the kahal is built into the system, which is really neat here. It's really neat to see that it's part of it since this time. So Tanu Rabbanan, here's the Braita about that. Haholech lahak bilpnei aviv, the one who goes to really visit his father, or opnei rabo, or his teacher, pnei misha gadol mimenu, or someone who's greater than him in Torah scholarship, uver ad tzavarro b'mayim, may pass through a stream up until his neck in water. Ve'eino choshesh. And don't be so worried. You're not going and bathing there. If you need to pass through water up to your neck, you go. The Gemara poses a related question. They inquired in the academy, what's the law regarding the teacher passing through a stream in order to be with his student? So the opposite way around. The Gemara provides an answer. Tashma. Come in here. The Amar Rav Yitzchak Bar Bar Chana, Rav Yitzchak Bar Bar Chana says, Anna Hazite L'Zivri D'Azal Gaber Rav Chia Bar Ashi Talmidei. I once observed Rav Zivri going through a stream to be with Rav Chia Bar Ashi, who's his student. Now, Rav Ashi Amar. Rav Ashi says, Hahu Rav Chia Bar Ashi Hu De'Azal L'Gabei De'Iri Rabei. In that incident, it was Rav Chia Bar Ashi who went through the stream to be with Ze'iri, his teacher. In other words, that was Ze'iri, his teacher. So he's Gadol Mimenu. And if it's someone greater than you, you have the permission, according to that, where we are there. But someone, you know, someone who's just a Talmid, someone who's just a student, you don't do it for. Another exception. Rav Asher al Bnei Avar Yamina Lemevar B'Mayya Lenutzul Reperoi. Rav permitted the people of Avar Yamina to pass through water in order to guard the fruits of the orchards they owned on the other side of the river. So wait a minute. Business, to guard the business loss or the harvest as a potential source of food, you could go and Eino Choshes, in other words, you don't worry. Amar Le Abai L'Rava, Abai says to Rava, Taya de Masayalach. A braita is taught that supports that even. Shom leperot ovrin ad savergan b'mayin. Those who guard produce may pass through a stream up until the necks in the water. Ve'ein choshishin. Don't worry. So in that sense, like the culture is that some people are going to have to go and guard the fruit. To guard fruits or vegetables is a very important job in the Gemara. Because orchards, you know, could be, even if they're walled, you have to really keep an eye. And these were important to the Jewish people. And on the festival days, right, when everybody was going to do festival stuff, are they going to be left just like this? No, we actually allow for the guards to do their work.
They didn't use Goy Shel Yom Kippur.
No, not according to this. And here's the thing. From these kinds of sources, we get the possibilities of putting people to work on guard duty. So if you go to certain communities and you have a group of volunteers who are really out there being shomrim of the streets and of the crossing, you know, of the crossings and of the different areas, you could kind of say that it comes even in here. What are our sweetest fruit? You know, our people, our children. People volunteer for those kinds of jobs, ushering included. I would say, you know, these kinds of things are very important, and you shouldn't worry that you're violating all of Yom Kippur by doing these kinds of activities. You can't worry.
Is up to the neck a limitation, or just an expression of how wet you can get?
It's interesting, because you might think that it would say, even if you have to swim and get your whole body like in there. I was thinking about it when I read the Brightas at some point. Like, okay, so what if there's a lot of flow there, you can't really like tiptoe through the water, you know, like a very still river, you can kind of, but a river, there's not a lot of very fast flowing rivers in the areas they're talking about, unless you're talking about Bavel, where there are some fast flowing rivers, right? So geographically, you could worry that you'd get your hair wet, that you'd have to swim a little bit. So the funny thing is that they're going to go into some discussion that we're not going to read it all inside, because I want to get to some other text. What if I have to put sandals on? Am I allowed to wear sandals into the water? The basic answer is no. You're not allowed. But who needs sandals? You're in water. Meaning that you're not really worried about the sharp rocks on the bottom, that you probably are wading. Right? So it's basically saying, like, wade through and don't worry.
Later, even modern Pusseks would use arguments like this.
Mm-hmm.
And one, as I think was suggested, one could say that it doesn't mean literally as a measurable limit up to the neck, but it's an expression that says you could even go so deep it's up to your neck, because if it was any higher, you couldn't breathe. So it's
right.
And just saying it's as far as you can go.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we use the expression in English today, right? What's the best use of that expression? Like, he's up to his neck in...
Yeah.
Trouble.
In
trouble.
In trouble, right. That's one of the areas. I was going to say, up to his neck in trouble, or up to his neck in concerns, worries.
In almost anything.
I wonder if it also is sort of the implication being you're allowed to get wet to the extent you really need to. Because regardless of how deep the water is, you can either walk across and it's up to here,
yeah.
Or if it gets any deeper than that, you're swimming.
That's right.
And in a sense,
right.
You know, there probably, other than by accident, isn't any good reason for it. You know.
Yeah. The interesting verb here is makbil. It said in the beginning of the Brayta that he went to makbil.
Makbil.
Yeah. So.
Makbil b'nei aviv.
Right. So what do you make of that verb?
He went to see his teacher or his father. Lekabel panav, the kmo lekabel kabbalat shabbat.
Right. So the notion is that you are lehakbil. You cause your father or your teacher to be the mikabel.
It's so welcoming. It's lehakbil is to welcome, which means they're coming to you and you rise up to the occasion.
Right.
That's lehakbil.
So what I'm saying is that the son or the student is bringing life to the father or the teacher. And so I think what it's saying is that those people can't make it to shul. And he goes, and he's going there to bring kind of himself there, so that it causes the moment of receiving the son or the student on Yom Kippur. There's a mitzvah on holidays. This is a whole other area, and it happens through Moed. which is this section of the Talmud and this section of the Mishnah, about on certain holidays and on certain kinds of days that you are required to go visit a teacher. And that if you're in the same area as them, you should go visit your teacher. And is it your teacher or your parent? It becomes a question. And teachers sometimes turn out.
Are you allowed to vary on Yom Kippur?
No.
It's a mitzvah not to keep the dead above God.
No, we would wait. We wait on certain Yom Tov. Even if it's a mitzvah. Okay. So what?
Can we wait on Shabbat?
Sure. 78A2. Let's go to 78A2. You want to cool off, and you don't have a good, you know, one of these kinds of situations where you can go into the water up to your neck. You thought you were going to cool off by sitting in mud. Well, we'll tell you what's going to happen. 78A2 on the left side. Tana Yehuda bar Gergarot. Yehuda bar Gergarot taught the following in a brayta. Asur leishev al gabei tina b'yom ha-kippurim. It's forbidden to sit on mud on Yom Kippur. So, you know, the notion is, A, it could be very hot and the mud is like, you know, a cool enough place to sit. B, it's simply about the washing and that you want to get some of the moisture for whatever the reason. I mean, I don't know why exactly you want dirty kind of moisture. But C, what it's also like Mashiach in the sense that people use mud like from the Dead Sea, right?
We just learned that if you get mud on you, you're allowed to wash.
So yeah, if you're really...
You can't play games.
Right, don't play games. I like that. I like that. Right. Okay, good. Good. So no playing games and like rolling around in the mud and then thinking I got to go wash. All right, we'll take it like that. Amar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says, Uvatina mitapachat, and the brightness speaks of mud that oozes moisture. Amar Abaye. Abaye says, Uvatofeach al-manat lahatpiach, and the brightness speaks of mud that is moist to the degree that it can give whatever touches its capacity to moisten something else. Gemara says this too in terms of cooling off. Amar Rav Yehuda, mutar lahitanen befeirot. It's permitted to cool oneself with fruits. Now, I tried this week to cool myself with fruits. You'd call me crazy. I should have videoed it so you believe me. I tried this week. Now, not the ones from the refrigerator. But I tried to see if leaving some clementines out that had clipot, that have were cooling at all, when I took them and I went like this. They weren't so cooling. They just weren't so cooling. I don't know exactly what type of fruit they're talking about. But if you look at the note, it says, by pressing a cool gourd against his flesh. Now, I did not have any gourds.
Shaded, cool area, like partially underground.
Right.
And it may well,
right.
They may well have
their version of refrigeration,
the
closest they had.
The bigger the fruit, the more mass it has, and the slower it is to warm up.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess, you know, you imagine that it's some type of skin of some type of fruit that has a cooling effect in a certain way. Like they had, if you, the cucumbers, people, you know, I don't know. But
in my younger years, we grew watermelons. We grew up on the farm, watermelons.
Uh-huh.
And no refrigeration in those days. How do we cool them? You cut it in half, you let it sit in the breeze, and it really cools. It really cools because it evaporates.
Oh.
And we did.
Watermelon the shade.
So, yes, you
okay.
can. And it's a big watermelon, you know, you can cool yourself with that.
Okay, so there you go. There's no using fruit to cool yourself off. In case anybody thought that was the way you're going to do a hot Yom Kippur, you now know.
I'll stick with AC.
Right? Right. Rava mitzdanen biyanuka. Rava would cool himself off with a baby. That's a funny one, too. Rava mitzdanin b'chasa d'chaspa, and Rava would cool himself with a silver cup. Now that I can see, right? Because somehow they're always, you know, seemingly a little cool to the touch. We have a bunch of silver cups for Shabbos. They're always a little cool. Amar Rav Papa. Rav Papa says, "Kasa d'chaspa male asur." To cool oneself with a silver cup that's full is prohibited. Chaser shari, but with a silver cup that's not full, it's permitted. Defachra, with regard to cups made of earthenware, idi b'idi asur. Cooling off with both a full and a non-full cup is prohibited. Mishum de mishchal shachil, because the liquid seeps through the sides of the cup. So let's just say that on Yom Kippur, here, there's some forbidding cooling off, but back to the beginning, towards the beginning of the Mishnah and the Gemara that was towards the beginning, remember it said that we are not talking about sitting in the blazing hot sun and subjecting ourselves to incredible amounts of heat. The notion that one would find a way to cool oneself off if one is too hot, definitively at this part of the Gemara, is answering the question, if you had any question regarding that passage we learned before, that said maybe we're talking about sitting in the hot sun, maybe we're talking about being really overheated in terms of inui nefesh. No, we don't mean that. Cool yourself off with either this or that. Just don't use this. Okay, now we've answered. Yet again. We weren't really worried that we had to sit in the hot sun or sit in the real severe cold. But we now even see the Gemara comes back to it in a spiral kind of fashion and tells us, here's how you can cool yourself off. Now let's go to 78b3. I just want to point out that the king and the bride may wash their faces was part of the Mishnah on the right-hand side of 78b3. And they go through and they kind of look at who can wear shoes and who can wash, because they really want to make the new bride beautiful to her husband. They want the royalty to not suffer in terms of his own place and splendor. The Gemara will go forward. With a few minutes left, I'm just going to bring you through a couple of the issues here. We've already talked about the date bulk. Turn to 78b4. On the right-hand side, one who eats the equivalent of a large date, ha'ochel kechotevet hagasa, right? And what they're going to do here is explore, by the end of the Gemara on our Mishnah, they're going to say, okay, let's talk about that date bulk again. Turn to 79a1 now. No, 79, the next page. I don't have a little...
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a 79a, right? There's no little number. You have that too? Okay, I thought it was a misprint over here. So 79a... regarding the equivalent of the date, right? Chechotevet she'amru. The sage is stated in the Mishnah, Begar inata ova lo gar inata. Does that mean with the pit or without its pit? Remember that was the discussion? Whether the hollow space in there is going to be part of the volume and the bulk that I measure, or with the pit. And then on the right-hand side, 79A, on the bottom five lines on the right-hand side, Uchishenatnu lo l'rabi tzadok ochel pachot Mika Beitza. The Mishnah continues, but when they gave Rav Tzadok food smaller than the size of an egg's bulk, and now I'm talking about it, Sukkot, and the holiday of Sukkot, where you have to eat anything that is an official meal, where? In the Sukkah. When they gave him less than the size of an egg, what did he do? Nitalo v'mapa v'achalo chutz l'sukkah. He actually ate that measurement, and he ate it outside the sukkah, v'lo beira hacharav, and he didn't say birkat hamazon, suggesting that there is a measure of food that one can eat and still be within the realm of doing all the mitzvahs you need to, right? There's a measure you can eat outside the sukkah. And if there's a measure that's smaller than a meal for which I need to bless, and I can eat it outside the sukkah, then I might be able to learn over here for Yom Kippur that there's a measure of food that I could eat or water I could drink that is less than any official amount of actual eating, ingesting, drinking, and then being responsible for eating the prescribed measure that gets me the punishment of karet, that gets me the punishment of being excommunicated. And the Gemara will go forward and start to ask questions. Are we talking about dates with the pit, dates without the pit, two dates without the pit, one with the pit? Is one with the pit the same as a beitza, the same as that eggs measure? You know, like, what is this tamar really? And then, you know, in terms of 79b2, there's a discussion about how much with chametz, to link this all to different yontivs, by the way, how much with chametz can I have, the seor, the possible thing that becomes chametz, I can have only chazait, an olives bulk, and with chametz, by the way, actual chametz, bechotevet, that's with the equivalent to a dates bulk, right? And so now I come back to my Mishnah, and our measurements in Yoma, same as that chametz, which is around that I had to have a dates bulk to really be required for any kind of punishment. Oh, now I see, like, these measurements all really matter, not only for my Yom Kippur holiday, but I see that these measurements are the rabbinic measurement system. And I wonder, like, oh, okay, so Yontif is going to be about somehow measuring out the right things, especially if I need to just have a little taste or just have a little drop of water on my tongue, right? And by the way, since I learned those other passages that we study tonight, and if I do some of these things, what did it say to me time and again? Eino choshesh. Don't worry so much. So what if I need to take a little touch of water because my tongue is, like, absolutely dry, and it's, you know, less than a cheekful. It's less than even half a cheekful. Should I worry? I think that the Gemara was saying, don't worry so much. Don't worry so much. And I'm going to tell you which measurements you can actually use if it's absolutely necessary for you. And those measurements, 80A3 now, 80A3, the source of those measurements is from Sinai. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, I'm on the left-hand side, after the first break, 80A3. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Shiurin ve'onashin, halacha l'Moshe miSinai. Measurements and punishments are part of the body of law transmitted to Moses on Sinai. Onashin michativ kativi. Punishments. Let's talk about those, though. Are they all really there, or are they not really there? Eila hachikama, rather, Rabbi Yochanan actually said this, Shirim shel onashin halacha l'Moshe miSinai. The legal measures of the punishments are oral law transmitted to Moses at Sinai. In other words, I have some that's directly transmitted, a la Torah itself, and I have some that's oral Torah, and here it is right here for us in the Gemara. I now understand how much of things I am to eat, how much the measure is vis-a-vis punishments, and since I know that Moshe is the source, and I always go back to Moshe to really feel connected to my Sinai experience, I'm living out the Sinai experience and Torah as it came to our teacher Moshe right from then, except the Gemara adduces support for an interpretation that certain things actually were legislated later, and says, Tanya Nami Hachi, Shirin shel onashin halacha l'Moshe miSinai. The legal measures of the punishments are oral law transmitted to Moses at Sinai. Acherim omim, but there are yet others who still say Beit Dino shel Yabetz tiknum. The court of Yabetz instituted them, meaning the guy who's mentioned in Chronicles, which is what in terms of the Tanakh, the end, Divrei Hayamim, the very end of my Tanakh, the end of my canon, if you will. And, you know, pretty much they're thinking that people at least relate to this a little chronologically, even if everything's not exactly in chronological order in our Tanakh. That they're still legislating based on the inheritance of legal tradition and legal possibility that Moses gave them. Gave to whom? Batei Din. They've established that these measurements, they've established that these punishments, by the end of our Mishnah's Gemara, which is coming quick to a close within a couple of paragraphs here before we get to the next Mishnah, that here we see that this truly is, we're saying as our authority as a Beit Din and as rabbis is linked directly to who? To Moses on Sinai, to major Beit Din, to major legislators in the days of, you know, and here Yabetz is the first judge after Joshua. Nachon. He's the first judge mentioned in Shoftim. His leadership is mentioned in Chronicles. And we have, in that sense, a link to the great process of the unfolding emet, the truth of Torah. And our measurements truly come from there. And you can trust these Mishnaic measurements we're giving you and how to think about them vis-a-vis the eating and drinking you do on Yom Kippur. To just point out the very last piece before the next Mishnah, turn to 81a1. When they talk about food and drink combining, they are interested in knowing whether or not those two combine, right? The Mishnah's ruling was they do not. And why do they not? Because we have a tradition vis-a-vis Tumah, impurities, that if two things have different measurements and two different numbers of days that they make you impure, we don't put them together. And since I can kind of see that eating and the notion of eating and drinking is on account of putting the mind to ease on this day, and I'm not talking about the sense that either one comes combined with the other to put your mind at ease, I can say that you don't really combine the two of them. So listen, here's how it goes. Mantana. Who is the Tana who taught that different items like food and drink don't combine? Amar Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda says, B'machloket shnuya. The opinion is actually recorded elsewhere as being disputed. For Rabbi Yehoshua he, and it's that of Rabbi Yehoshua, Didnan, who ruled, Klal Amar Rabbi Yehoshua, here's the rule, Kol Shetumato V'shiro Shave Mitztaref. All items whose Tumah transmission and legal measure are equal, combined with one another to complete the measure. So is the measure of a date bulk the same as the measure of a cheekful? No. So if that's the case, I don't really have to worry about the two of them combining. And what I get from the sense of the discussion is that really what we're asking for is something that will just basically put one's mind to ease on the day of Yom Kippur, and I don't really have to worry about the combined amounts. I don't worry so much. I get a little bit of measurement within the reality of my experience that will allow me to fulfill the broad scope of afflicting my soul, of afflicting myself, or even tormenting myself a little, or, you know, experiencing this religious spiritual pressure. I now have a full-out curriculum for these five different kinds of approaches that I've got to take on Yom Kippur. All of these religious practices now are much more dynamic based on the Gemara that's here in the Talmud, and let's call it a semester of great learning on one Mishnah. You see how much one Mishnah can generate? Shar Koach.
Thank you.
See you tomorrow.